As I said at the beginning of the service, I had some great ideas with lots of theology about this reading. And then Wednesday happened. And I felt like I was in a rerun on the news. On Thursday night, as the nation was reeling yet again from yet another mass shooting by yet another troubled young white male at yet another school, as the politicians and the paid talking heads were lining up to echo yet again the same tired cliches and thoughts and prayers they echoed after Sandy Hook and after Virginia Tech and after Columbine and after the dozens of other school shootings whose names you don't know because the death toll was under 15. On that Thursday night, one person seemed to break the mold. And that person was an experienced, wizened, former FBI official named Phil Mudd, who has seen a lot of stuff in his day. And in the middle of a serious and sober CNN interview with Wolf Blitzer about the shooting, Mr. Mudd broke down. And choking back tears, he said of the 17 killed, "A child of God is dead. Cannot we acknowledge in this country that we cannot accept this? I can't do it, Wolf," he added. And then crying, "I'm sorry, I can't do it." And around the country today, pastors are choking back the same words as they try to say something healing on this gray Sunday morning. "But I can't do it." We will try. That's what you pay us for. I have friends this Sunday who are getting super political, and they are preaching about the need for stronger gun control laws and background checks and limits on the sale of military assault weapons to children. And I don't know. Maybe that will help. I don't know. Other pastors from a different perspective will talk about how guns are not the issue. It is broken youth caused by video games and the lack of prayer in schools, and we need to go back to being a Christian nation like we were in the 1950s. And something about mental health. Maybe that will help. I don't know. Here's what I do know. I know that we are the only developed nation on earth that sees this kind of mass insanity on a tragically regular basis. To the point where, unless at least 15 kids get killed in one incident, we don't even remember the name of the school anymore. Umpqua College? Red Lake High? Oikos University, West Nichols Mine School, Northern Illinois, Marysville Pilchuck High, University of Arizona Tucson. I could go on, but I'm only allowed to preach for 25 minutes. What I do know is that young, troubled kids have easier access to weapons designed for expert warriors to kill as many other enemy expert warriors as quickly and efficiently as possible. Weapons of death, the likes of which our founding fathers could not imagine. And when they wrote in the Second Amendment about the need for a well-regulated militia, Nicholas Cruz shooting his fellow students in the hallways was not what they had in mind. But I also don't think guns are the whole problem. There are millions and millions and millions of wonderful folk, tens of thousands in this state, who hunt and target shoot and have guns and are responsible, and it's fine. So there is more. And the other thing I do know is that we have a lot of damaged young men in this country who also have very easy access to weapons of mass killing. But I wonder if the crisis of damaged young men may be the bigger one with which we have to contend. I want to name some icons of mass media heroes of masculinity. I just want you to picture them in your mind as I go through a few of them. Sean Connery, John Wayne, Harrison Ford, Sylvester Stallone, Daniel Craig, Mr. Rogers. I didn't hear any giggles on the last one, but I could see a lot of smirks. Now, the first five names, did you picture them with a gun in hand? Hard not to. Can you even name some masculine movie characters that do not pack heat in most of their films? That's a serious question. Can you think of any? No, really. Robert Redford, except for some of his, Sundance, get that, yeah. Except for that one, I can't think of any. So, okay. I'm sorry? Day of the Condor, you might have. Okay, so, but you can imagine Robert Redford in a film without a gun in his hand. So they might have swords instead of guns. Yes, this is true. Yes, we have period films and Game of Thrones where nobody's got a gun, but they've got big, broad swords. Paul Newman, more of a race car driver. He's been in some films with guns. But Tom Hanks, there we go. That was one of the ones I have three written down. So Tom Hanks is one. Gregory Peck, except for the height. He was in some cowboy movies, but he was also in some other stuff. He's not always an action hero. But, Jimmy Stewart. He was in a couple of Westerns, but he's been in a lot of other things where he was about ideas and about doing the right thing in difficult times. Yeah? Cary Grant. Oh, was he in High Noon? No. That was good. Okay. I didn't have that. I had George Clooney, who's a couple of films he's had some guns. I was thinking Morgan Freeman. I could not think of one.
Unforgiven.
Okay. All right.
Gabby Hayes.
So here's a question. Why is Mr. Rogers not considered hero material? Yes, but why Mr. Rod? Why what about Mr. Rogers makes him not hero material?
He's gentle.
Compassion. What's that?
He's kind.
Kind. It doesn't appear strong. Doesn't appear strong. I didn't hear back here. Sorry. Mm-hmm. What's the most do?
He values children in a way.
He values children?
I mean, I'm certainly not saying the gun-slinging cowboy characters don't, but he's more upfront with his passion for young children who are defenseless and perhaps not always exciting. I think that's what comes to mind.
Gentle.
Yeah.
Gentle. see him in his cardigan, that's right.
How about Jim Henson?
Jim Henson. Mm-hmm. Has another, his movies and his characters were able to struggle to do the right thing in the midst of difficult situations. What's that? Well, yeah. Miss Piggy would have probably packed heat if she had a chance. But it's hard to, with the hoof, you can't pull triggers very well. What's fascinating, as I hear the adjectives you give to Mr. Rogers, is those are all the things, all the aspects of the man you want your daughter to marry, to have. But man, it makes for a boring movie. What's that? About Mr. Rogers? Yes, with Tom Hanks. There are, yeah. Oh, you're happy now. There's a term that was coined back in the 70s, and I don't like it at all. But it serves a purpose for this: toxic masculinity. And it doesn't mean that masculinity is toxic, but there are forms of masculinity, and the forms that we celebrate in this country are toxic forms of masculinity, where men are told that they are not allowed to express any emotion except anger and lust. Those are the two allowed emotions. Both of them based on testosterone. And also, it is conjoined with another aspect of our nation. I think more than any other nation, any other developed nation on earth, the U.S. has bought into the myth of redemptive violence. And movies are the best at this. There is no problem that cannot be fixed with a weapon in 2 hours of time. Longer if there's a plot complication. Killing the right person or people will solve the problem and everything will be okay. And if you do that, you will have a gorgeous babe hanging on your shoulder and hanging onto every clever double entendre you utter. It's a great way to end a film, and it's a great way to model what it is to be a man in our culture. Maybe it's because we haven't fought a war on our own soil in 150 years. Maybe it's because we no longer have a draft so that only a few families have to bear the brunt of foreign wars' devastations, but we've never woken up from the dream of redemptive violence as being the thing that fixes stuff. And we're living in an era where I think toxic masculinity and the myth of redemptive violence is creating some alienated young men who think they can fix their pain by hurting as many other people as possible. And the best way to do that is with an automatic weapon. Michael Ian Black, whom I have never quoted in a sermon before, he's a comedian, wrote, and I also don't quote Twitter because it's a vast wasteland, but he wrote this week, "Deeper even than the gun problem is this: boys are broken." He wrote, "The last 50 years redefined womanhood. Women were taught that they can do anything. No commensurate movement for men who are still generally locked into the same rigid, outdated model of masculinity, and it's killing us. If you want to hurt a man, the first thing you do is attack his masculinity. men don't have the language to understand masculinity as anything other than some version of a caveman because no language exists. The language of masculinity is hopelessly entwined with sexuality, and the language of sexuality is hopelessly entwined with power, agency, and self-worth. So men, and boys before that, don't have language for modes of expression that don't readily conform to traditional standards. To step outside those norms is to take a risk most of us are afraid to take, and as a result, a lot of guys spend their lives terrified. We're terrified of being viewed as something other than men. We know ourselves to be men, but don't know how to be our whole selves. A lot of us, me included, either shut off or experience deep shame or rage or all three. Again, men are terrified. And his last tweet was this: "Even talking about this topic invites ridicule because it's so scary for most men and women. Men are adrift and nobody is talking about it and nobody is doing anything about it and it's killing us." I think about my own son and daughter. My daughter is all the things you want a daughter to be. She's hardworking, she's considerate, she's smart, she's lovely. She deals with cultural and has been hurt by cultural norms that women are supposed to adhere to: body image, size, eating. It's still a patriarchy. But my daughter has a much broader horizon of who she can be and how she can be that than my wife did, or her grandmother, or her great-grandmother. The last 50 years have done amazing things for my daughter to be able to exercise her full humanity. And she's... Could we turn off the ghosts that haunt us? It might be worse. My son, not so much. The view of what it is to be a man that he has grown up with is not that different from the one I did. I mean, it's my generation that grew up with Mr. Rogers. My son didn't even get that. You could find an occasional example of someone who is strong and gentle and kind and thinking of others, someone who can express emotions other than rage and lust. There are a few of those examples, but what is poured, force-fed into him is this hyper-masculinized, toxic form of masculinity. And I think we are taught, boys are taught, and men hopefully are taught, and our girlfriends and wives ask us to be able to be in touch with our emotions, to know how to connect, you know, if we're feeling sad, if we're feeling vulnerable, if we're feeling any of those things. Please show me that. But a sociologist, Brené Brown, was interviewing a man about this very topic, and he goes, "It's not true. My wife will say, 'Please, I want you to be vulnerable. I want you to show me your sadness and pain.' But," he says, "the minute I fall off my white horse, the emotion is disgust. If I am ever vulnerable enough to actually show my hurt and my pain and my brokenness, the immediate reaction will be disgust because I'm not being a man." And it's ironic that our models of masculinity and what it is to be a man and what it is to be a woman both keep us from being fully human. And both keep us from connecting the way we want to. I mean, our most profound, desperate desire as human beings is to connect to another human being and to a community. Henry Nouwen says, "As I tried to listen to my own deepest yearnings as well as the yearnings of others, the word that seems best to summarize the desire of the human heart is communion." Communion. Now, Nouwen, although he's a Catholic priest, he was not talking about little wafers and Welch's juice and plastic shot glasses. He means in communion, meaning union with. God has given us a heart that will remain restless until it has found full communion. And we look for it everywhere, in healthy places and unhealthy places. We look for it in friendships, in marriage, in sexual intimacy, in moments of ecstasy, in the recognitions of our gifts and the way we can show it, share it with other people. We look for it through success. We look for it through admiration and rewards. But wherever we look, it's communion that we seek. Ultimately, I think what we're seeking is communion with God. But what we also really, really need is communion with that love, but with someone with flesh on. Brené Brown was saying that we want to belong. That's what communion is saying, being vulnerable enough to say, I belong to this person, I belong to God, I belong to this community, I belong to this family. We desperately want to belong. Ironically, we so want to belong that we are willing to sacrifice our most authentic selves in order to meet the expectations of the group we want to belong to, in which case what's actually belonging is not me. It's a mask over me. And hypermasculinity is a way that men protect themselves from that kind of vulnerability. To actually show who I really am in community is dangerous, because I can get hurt. I can get rejected. I will feel pain. And in incident after incident after incident in these high school and grade school shootings, we see young men who have been told they are other. And young men don't know how to handle that hurt except through hurting someone else. I have pain, and I've never been taught how to deal with pain, so I'm going to make someone else hurt the way I hurt. And the most efficient way to do that, and the way that'll make the news, is to do it with an AR-16. In Eden, we see the beauty of mutual vulnerability in Adam and Eve as a couple, in right relationship with each other, in right relationship with the earth in the garden, in right relationship with God, and we mess it up because it's what we do. We're human beings. They messed it up. We mess it up. There's repercussions to that, but God never leaves them. God continues to care for them even as they're expelled from the childhood of Eden into the rough adulthood of farming in the wilderness. But we see that vulnerability and the pain that comes from that vulnerability being violated. And then we have Jesus in the wilderness. Is there something beside, or someone besides Mr. Rogers that we can lift up as a way of redefining masculinity? Or is there a way, something we can see in the way Jesus did what he did in the wilderness as a way that can redefine what it is to be a man for us? I'm seeing some nodding. Would anyone be willing to risk saying what we might learn here? Jesus is confronting the slanderer, the voice that says, you are not worthy. You do not belong. You are not what you've been told you are. You are not beloved. You are not God's child. If you are, you would meet my expectations by doing a magic trick with bread, doing a magic trick off the top of the temple, and bowing down before me. He confronts that voice. He doesn't swallow it. He doesn't project it onto somebody else. He confronts it. He talks it out. He doesn't use an AK-47 on the slanderer. He doesn't destroy the slanderer. He confronts, tells truth to power, knows who and whose he is, and leaves transformed from the experience. That's not our model that our culture offers us, but maybe the Bible offers us a real powerful way of approaching what it is to be a man and a woman. I mean, this is a very holistic way of looking at it. But can we learn how to sit with our pain without inflicting pain on someone else? Can we hear a voice that says, you are my beloved? With you I am well pleased. Can you hear that voice over and above the voice that says, you're not enough? If you were a woman, it might be, you're not skinny enough, sexy enough. You're not able to have 3 kids and hold down a full-time job and be the perfect mom all at the same time. You're not good enough. If you're a man, it's you're not strong enough. It's the worst thing you can say to a guy. You're not enough. You're not strong enough. You're not man enough. You're not responsible enough. But if we can hear the voice that says, you are my beloved child in whom I am well pleased, and you can see the person next to you and recognize that they are a beloved child of God in whom God is well pleased. Not as an other, but as a brother or a sister who you don't need to project your pain onto or inflict your pain onto, but can work with and love and to be in right relationship with. Jesus takes that pain and transforms it into a different way of doing ministry and being with the people he loves. Our culture says to men, you're not supposed to feel pain. When you feel pain, you project it onto somebody else or cause it with somebody else, cause it to somebody else. Jesus says, I will take your pain. You don't have to project it onto me. I accept it. I will transform it. I will bring you healing and wholeness through it. You can be whole in me. I didn't have a snappy conclusion written up because I'm making it up as I go along here because I didn't know where I was going to go today. But for men and for women, we have a new model for being fully human in this dusty, hungry, thirsty rabbi from Nazareth who helps us to hear the voice that says we are beloved and helps us learn again how to live in right relationship with one another. The irony that from the Son of God we learn how to be fully human. We can say yes to that love. No experience required. No AK-47 required. Just a heart open.